So I'm going to be talking tonight about play. Before I get started or say anything else and taint your minds at all, I want each one of you to take just a minute and I want you to pay attention to the first thing that comes to your mind when you hear the word play. Whatever that thing is, I want you to hold on to it, because I'm going to come back to it later in the lecture, but you have to stick with your first answer, okay? One of the great things about giving a lecture on play is that I'll probably have the cutest visual presentation of anybody else this term. I'm going to start with this right here, which you guys are not going to be able to see very well, but you can come look at it after the lecture. This is a Lego drink fountain that was built by Abby Kies. She's been in Nikki's seven-year-old. I interviewed some children, rightly so, for this lecture. And when I was interviewing Abby, she had many things to say. I won't share all of them with you tonight. But one of the things is she said, "Oh, I have something you have to take to the lecture. You have to take it, so that the grown-ups will know what kind of things kids do when they play." So this is a Lego drink fountain. There's also a variety of ice cream flavors available. And if you come look at it afterwards, there's a little pink disc in the back. And I asked Abby what that was. And she said, "It's a bird bath, because birds need drinks too." So there you go. So feel free to come look at it after the lecture. Please be careful. If I take it back in pieces, it'll be bad. It'll be bad for me. So, and I live in the same house with Abby, so be kind to it. Okay, so the idea of play is at once both terribly simple, but also quite ambiguous and complex. I had a harder time getting my hands around this topic than I had anticipated when I chose it several months ago. When we hear the word play, most of us immediately think about children. I'm going to talk tonight about children in play, but I'm also going to talk about adults in play. I chose this topic for two reasons. In my former life, before I was a Libri worker, I worked for about 10 years as a pediatric speech-language pathologist. And from my work in that area, I know how critical it is for children to develop appropriate play skills. There are a number of changes taking place, especially in the U.S. education system right now, as well as in our wider culture. They're really threatening children's ability to play well. I'm concerned about the changes and how children play, since play is the platform by which children begin to develop almost all of their essential life skills. Many adults today view play as something trivial or meaningless. They see it as something for kids to do so that real, meaningful adult tasks can get done, like getting dinner prepared or returning emails. When we describe something as being easy or mindless, we often describe it as being child's play. This line of thinking may seem like a small thing, but it actually has a serious impact on all of us. Because it's important for adults to play too. And if it's something that we easily dismiss, then we are that much less likely to engage in play ourselves. I want to think about what it means for all of us to continue playing into adulthood. G.K. Chesterton famously said, "Angels can fly because they take themselves lightly." This quote has been stitched upon many a throw pillow, but in reality, we grown-ups take ourselves quite seriously most of the time. I include myself in this. This is something that I struggle with personally, and I think many people do in our world of achievement and efficiency. I'm also going to talk a little bit about what play has to do with the Christian life, if anything. When I started working on this lecture, I started by asking, what is play? And I immediately got stuck. Actually, giving a definition to the word play is quite difficult. I looked up the dictionary definition, and of course, there are several, but a few of them stood out to me in particular. The first is to exercise or employ oneself in diversion, amusement, or recreation. To act the part or character of in real life, to engage in. So, that's fine, but I wanted to flesh this out a little bit more, so I went to the next best source after the dictionary, which is our Libri students. So they helped me. We had a great lunch discussion about this one day where they helped me flesh this out a little bit more. They also struggled to describe play. But there are a few things that they said. Play has to do with joy, imagination, fun, humor, trust, wonder, pleasure, creativity, improvisation, and lack of competition. I thought this was a pretty good list. There are a lot of things here that really resonate with me and hopefully resonate with you as well. But wanting to dig even deeper, I went to the real experts, to the children in my life. And here are a few of the things that they said. Claire said, I like to make things and build things. Michael said, grown-ups need to know that it's okay for kids to play with Play-Doh. Yeah. Ellie said, I love to play outside and I like playing with my friends. Abby said, grown-ups don't know how to play. They grow up and forget, so they have to learn again. Kids have to teach them. And Jacob said, I know a lot of things about play, but it's all in my head, and I can't actually tell you with my mouth. Why don't you do about a lecture about baseball instead? I could tell you a lot about baseball. So, I really had my work cut out for me as far as getting to the bottom of this. They were helpful, but not all that helpful. So, maybe instead of asking what is play, it's better to ask why does play matter? In order to do this, I'm going to give you a very quick lesson in early human development, neuroscience, and linguistics. So I'm just going to nerd out on you a little bit here. This was actually really fun for me to pull out some of this stuff I haven't thought about since graduate school. But hopefully it'll be interesting to you, not boring. I've already mentioned the growing thought that play is something that's frivolous for adults as well as children. But I strongly disagree with that idea, and research backs me up. For those of you who do not have children or don't regularly spend time with children, I don't want you to tune this out. If you're sitting in this room tonight and you have age-appropriate language skills, then what I'm about to talk about is your story. This is how you got to where you are right now. Play isn't just something for kids. It's critical for human development. It's a human thing. And this is something that defines all of us. So hang with me for this. We know from our friends in neuroscience that our brains are made up of neurons. Neurons are cells that we have throughout our bodies, but they're the primary way that information is mapped and transmitted in our brains. This is just a very basic overview of the human brain, take you back to ninth grade biology. Our brains are not actually red, purple, yellow, and blue, just saying that. Okay, this is a picture of a neuron. Each neuron has many branches off of it called dendrites, but most have one particularly long dendrite called the axon. The job of the axon is to send information from one neuron to another. This is the way that neural connections and neural pathways are created in our brains. Axons don't actually touch other neurons. Instead, they send chemicals called neurotransmitters across a space or a synapse to the other neuron. Those of you who've studied psychology at all, you know a lot about brain chemistry, neurotransmitters. That's what's happening here. That's kind of the basic building block of our brains. Babies develop over 100 billion neurons within the first 5 months of gestation. So not of life, within the first 5 months of gestation when they're still in the womb. But when newborns come out into the world, their brains are only about the quarter of a size of an adult brain. However, it grows to about 80% of an adult's brain by age 3 and to 90% of an adult brain by age 5. With every sensory experience, no matter how small or seemingly insignificant, new neural connections are made. The type of connections made and the rate at which they are made has a great deal to do with cognitive functioning down the road. Children's brains are wired to make these connections much more quickly and efficiently than adults' brains. This is what is referred to as brain plasticity, the ability of the brain to form new connections and pathways. This is why it's so much easier for children to learn a foreign language or a new skill such as playing the violin or learning to ski than it is for adults. There's a fairly steep drop-off in brain plasticity around the age of 12 or 13, and it continues to decrease over the lifespan. It's never totally lost, but the adult brain's ability to form new connections and pathways slows down with age. Babies come into the world with all kinds of neural possibilities. They have the ability to integrate sensory information and the potential to do all kinds of amazing things. Write symphonies, do quantum physics, tie their shoes, cook eggs, speak six languages. But what happens in their brains in the early years plays a critical role in determining what they will be able to do down the road, how they will think and integrate and perform. But the starting point on the journey is play. Sharon Begley is a former science columnist for Newsweek magazine, and in one of her columns she says this: You hold your newborn so his sky blue eyes are just inches from the brightly patterned wallpaper. Zzz. A neuron from his retina made an electrical connection with one in his brain's visual cortex. You gently touch his palm with a clothespin. He grasps it, drops it, and you return it to him with soft words and a smile. Crackle. Neurons from his hand strengthen their connection to those in his sensory motor cortex. He cries in the night. You feed him, holding his gaze, because nature has seen to it that the distance from a parent's crooked elbow to his eyes is exactly matches the distance at which a baby can focus. Zap! Neurons in the brain's amygdala send pulses of electricity through the circuits that control emotion. You hold him on your lap and talk, and neurons from his ears start hardwiring connections to the auditory cortex, and you thought you were just playing with your kid. So why does play matter? When babies and children play, they are learning. It looks like they're hanging out doing nothing, but they're learning. Batting the mobile hanging above their crib, gnawing on the corner of a book, stacking blocks and knocking them down again, pushing a toy car, repeatedly dropping their cup off of the high chair tray, banging a spoon against the coffee table. This is what learning looks like. Not flashcards, not baby Einstein videos, and not reading by the age of 3. And I would argue that they're doing the most important learning of their lives, far more important than that algebra class that will come a few years down the road. I want to show you what the typical development of play looks like, and I'm going to introduce you to a few of my cute friends along the way. So there's 6 stages of object play that develop essentially between birth and roughly the age of 5. The first is random and exploratory play. This starts shortly after birth, and this is when babies start to grasp for familiar people or toys, and they do repetitive motor movements such as mouthing, banging, shaking, and batting at toys. I'm going to show you a little video of my friend Tate. Tate is, he's maybe 5 weeks old now, and I'm just going to let you watch him for a second. Okay, there's actually a lot happening there. There's a lot happening there. You can't see her, his mom. His mom actually videoed this for me. So he's looking at the mobile. He's looking at his mom. It's an amazing thing. A couple weeks ago, he couldn't do that. And he's copying her. She shakes it, and he reaches out and is able to grab it and reacts to that rattle. There's a lot happening. There's a lot happening in his brain with that. The second step is cause and effect play. This comes out around 9 months. And this is a more purposeful interaction as the child learns that they have some control. They can push, they can pull, they can pound things. This is where cause and effect toys and battery-operated toys are really effective. Caregivers become a cause and effect toy. So if they drop their cup and mom picks it up, and they drop their cup and mom picks it up, the parent becomes essentially a cause and effect toy for them. The third stage is purposeful or functional play. This emerges about 15 to 18 months. The child starts to demonstrate understanding of the use of objects, such as throwing a ball in a basket or moving trains on a track. They can also, even if they don't have a lot of language, can respond to directions. So if you said, what do you eat? They could point to an apple or go pick up something that's food to show that they understand that. Now I'm going to show you a video of Zach. Zach is my buddy. He is 17 months old, and it's a little hard to hear on this, but there's a lot of things happening in this video. Zach's mom is here tonight. So to be fair, I totally set Zach up for failure. I wanted him, I really wanted some footage of Zach with a shape sorter that you'll see, kind of an old-fashioned shape sorter. He had never seen the shape sorter before the day I went. He has one that's smaller that has like four shapes, but he'd never seen this one before. He has two older sisters who were like all up in his face and wouldn't leave him alone. So we got a little bit of the shape sorter, but you're gonna see a couple things. You're gonna see Zach with the shape sorter. I don't know if you can hear this or not, but his older sister is sitting on the couch reading a book out loud to herself. Tracy, his mom, tells her to be quiet. Tells Claire to be quiet, and you'll see Zach do a shh, and then he looks at me and whatever. So, okay. So there's a lot happening there with Zach. Zach's 17 months old. He has a couple words. He doesn't have a ton of words, but he actually had been working pretty hard at that shape sorter, to be fair. But you see, again, with the purposeful play, he's doing the shape sorter, but then he realizes he can do something else with it, which is a lot more fun and immediately satisfying, which is shaking it. And when Tracy tells Claire to be quiet and he does that, shh, Zach isn't at a point yet where he can't say be quiet, but he knows what's going on there. Tracy wasn't talking to him, but he knows what's going on with that. And then his attention turns to the ball, and he's like, ball, and on to the next thing. The fourth stage of object play is representational or symbolic play. This happens at about 3 years when kids begin to use symbolism in play, such as like a cardboard box becomes a house or a spoon can become a phone. They also start playing with things out of context, so they're integrating more memory and past experiences into their play. I'm going to talk a little bit more about this in a little bit. This is really, really critical for language development, this type of development of symbolic play. The fifth stage is constructive play, and this comes out about 4 years of age. And children use objects for specific purposes and goals, so creating with Play-Doh, building with Legos, using chalk, things like that. And then the sixth stage is an imaginative or themed play. This comes out around 4 to 5 years, and this is play based on past events and involves a number of sequence steps. And children pretend to do or to be something other than themselves. And this video is, this is Ethan. Ethan is four, he's almost four and a half. He has some articulation issues. He's a little hard to understand, so I'm narrating a little bit. The original video was too long for me to put on here, so he has made with Legos a flying ice cream truck. That's what he has in his hand. He's already given me ice cream, and I can't remember if I narrate over this, but it's hard to understand what he says at the beginning, but he's essentially talking about reloading the ice cream truck, and he's getting five different kinds of ice cream. You'll hear me talking on this one.
Yeah, so I
want
to change. I
already dropped
them.
But I have to get some more.
I'm going to get five of them. So he's reloading his ice cream? Stocking up?
Yeah, he has to go to the gas.
To go get gas?
Yeah, so I ran out of gas.
Uh-oh. That'd be bad news if the ice cream truck runs out of gas.
There's the gas station.
Close the door. Fill her up.
He's ready for action again.
I want you to just kind of note the really significant differences between Tate, between Zach, and between Ethan. Everything from body control and strength to their visual focus to gross and fine motor skills to attention, cognition, language. And this is covering a span of 4 years. Yeah, Tate is almost 5 weeks, and Ethan is about four and a half. And I just want you to think about that, because I think we take this for granted, that that's what kids do when they develop. But think about what you've accomplished in the last 4 years. It doesn't really hold a candle to this at all. I mean, I'm sure you're great, but it doesn't in any way. But I think we see kids grow and we see them, they hit these milestones like this, and it's really easy to take that for granted. But there's so much happening. There's so much happening at this stage. And the progression you see here is a move away from concrete uses of objects towards an increase in the symbolic and abstract nature of objects. I can't stress enough how critical that progression is for development of language and higher level cognition skills. In our everyday lives, we're simultaneously operating in both concrete and abstract realms. Symbolic play is integral to language development. Language at its core is a symbol system where we use an expansive system of visual and auditory symbols in order to understand and express variable and complex ideas. The human capacity for development of language is directly connected to the development of symbolic play. Now I'm going to give you a little bit of a linguistics lesson. As babies develop into toddlers and toddlers develop into preschoolers and kindergartners and big kids, the neurons in their brains are forming connections at an alarmingly rapid rate. They're forming neural pathways and mapping information in the brain. When a child hears an adult articulate the sounds in this order, b, a, o, neuronal connections in the auditory cortex translate that into a cognitive concept of something that is round and bounces and is usually used for games. But if we reverse the sounds, okay, so that it's l, a, b, we get something totally different, a place where scientists work. So once we learn to read and write, we also rely on visual symbols to ascribe meaning to things. So there I've actually spelled the word the way it's supposed to be spelled, ball. But if you replace one letter, and I want you to notice I'm not adding a sound here, I'm adding a letter, then all of a sudden that visual symbol means something totally different. It's no longer something that is round and can roll and bounce, used for playing games, but it's something else. It might be round, but it's made of hay and it's found in a field or on a farm. So the L and the E here at the end of those words are essentially silent letters. They're not making a sound, so we haven't changed the sound. The vowel has actually changed a little bit, but I'm not actually adding sounds. But visually, those two things symbolize something completely different. And this is what kids are working out when they're learning to talk and they're learning to read and to write. So a child's ability to play well, to play symbolically and abstractly, is closely tied to their ability to acquire language, what they understand, how they talk, and what they say, and what they can read and write. All of those neurotransmitters firing and the neural pathways being created are really critical. So play, in fact, is not just for fun. It's not just a silly thing that kids do, something to keep them out of their mom's hair during dinner prep. Play isn't isolated to humans, but it is part of what makes us human. And it's a huge component of what sets us apart from the rest of the animal world, and that is language. Language is a significant thing that makes us human, and it's a significant thing that connects us to God. Genesis tells us that God spoke the universe into being. And the Gospel of John tells us Jesus is the Word. So this is a really crucial link, not just for our humanity, but our connection to our Creator as well. So what does play accomplish? Just a few things. Play is integral to a child's brain development, creativity, curiosity, cognitive, language, motor, and social-emotional skills. Through play, children learn how to learn. They gain problem-solving skills. They deal with frustration. They experience intrinsic motivation. They practice new skills, explore risks, make choices, gain independence, concentrate, test boundaries, and most importantly, they have fun. But we have a problem. This is all pretty cool. But in the past few decades, our view of play has changed. Adults are busy, and children are busy. The world is a more dangerous place. Kids don't have the time or freedom to roam freely as they did in previous generations. And this is a really, really big problem. I've just shown you why play is important for humans, specifically for language and cognitive development. But I'm going to talk now about what's happened culturally in the last few decades to change our view of play. And now I'm going to go back to the question that I asked you at the beginning of the lecture. I am going to make you raise your hands here. When I asked you to think of the first thing that came to mind when I mentioned play. So I want you to raise your hands. For how many of you, when I said play, was the thing that you thought of a specific activity? Okay. For how many of you was the thing that you thought of a specific toy or an object? Okay, a lot of people did not respond just now. Okay. That's interesting. I'm not totally putting people in categories here, but people, the people who responded that what they thought of was more of an activity are a bit older. Yeah. Than some of you who said what you thought of was a toy. So there's four main changes that have happened culturally in the last 50 or so years I'm going to talk about that have altered our attitudes around play. And the first is advertising. According to Alex Spiegel in a segment for NPR, prior to the mid-1950s, toy companies had tiny advertising budgets and therefore primarily reserved all of their advertising for the Christmas season. But in 1955, the toy giant Mattel began advertising a toy gun called the Thunder Burp. The gun had sold well initially, but many of the toys were returned to the company because the children needed more directions on how to operate. Around that time, the ABC television network offered Mattel a sponsoring opportunity for their new show, The Mickey Mouse Club, in exchange for advertising time for the Thunder Burp gun. No one really remembers the Thunder Burp now, but it was a watershed moment in history. Advertising for toys became much more commonplace, and all of a sudden, children's play became less focused on certain activities and more focused on specific toys, increasingly designed to address certain aspects of play and predetermined scripts. Howard Chudikoff, a cultural historian at Brown University, said, quote, "Almost overnight, children's play became focused, as never before, on things, on the toys themselves," end quote. He argues that up until this point in human history, children's play consisted of children playing outside, roaming around in large or small packs, largely unsupervised, and for hours at a time. They were seemingly doing nothing. He says, they improvised their own play, they regulated their play, and they made up their own rules. Think about that for a minute in comparison to the children that you know now. And think about that in comparison to your own childhood. Spiegel says, Chudikoff argues, during the second half of the 20th century, play changed radically. Instead of spending their time in autonomous shifting make-believe, children were supplied with ever more specific toys for play and predetermined scripts. Essentially, instead of playing pirate with a tree branch, they played Star Wars with a toy lightsaber. Chudikoff calls this the commercialization and co-optation of children's play, a trend which begins to shrink the size of children's imaginative space. Another trend that dovetails nicely with the increase in advertising of toys is the use of toys for marketing purposes. It's commonplace now for any popular television show or movie targeted at children and tweens to have a whole line of merchandise to go along with it, primarily consisting of toys. So even within the realm of toys, toys themselves are becoming more and more specific, allowing less space for creativity, exploring, and imagination. A good example of this is the contrast between good old-fashioned wooden blocks, which can be used to build anything. They can be used for hiding, throwing, hammering, all sorts of things. And they can become something different every single day. I want to compare this with Legos, and I love Legos. Legos are great. But specifically the more modern Legos that they've put out in the last couple years, which are now more commonly sold in specific sets, such as this one. This is Hagrid's hut from the Harry Potter movies. So it's a set to build his hut. Like the wooden blocks, building with Legos helps kids work on their fine motor and visual perception skills. But by labeling this Hagrid's hut, all creativity, imagination, and exploration is taken out of that activity. Instead of creating something novel, kids intently study the multi-page directions that give step-by-step instructions on how to build Hagrid's hut. And then once it's built, it's just kind of done. I have seen these instruction booklets, and they are difficult. Like, they're really detailed. It's amazing. So once you build this thing, what do you do with it next? Nothing, really. Of course, the Legos can still be used to build anything, and it can be combined with other Legos to build anything, but that's rarely what happens, as the toy is designed for kids to keep it in this certain niche. I do want you to know, Back to Abby's Legos for a minute. I did ask her if this drink fountain was a set. She assured me it is not. She created it herself with all kinds of Legos. So this is, you cannot purchase the Lego drink fountain. This is one of a kind from Abigail Cox. The next cultural shift that's really impacted children's play in the last 50 years is parents increasing safety concerns around their children, which has come with a sharp uptick in parents' constant supervision of their children. In her article, The Overprotected Kid, from The Atlantic, author Hannah Rosen explores the ways that our obsession with safety has stripped children of independence and self-discovery, this is the key here, without actually making them any safer. According to Rosen, there were two major events that spiked this trend in the late 70s. The first was a number of key public lawsuits filed by parents whose children sustained serious injuries as a result of playing on public playgrounds. All of a sudden, safety experts were testifying left and right in court cases about the potential dangers of playground equipment, and these same experts rained down a new set of guidelines for children's playgrounds as a result. According to Rosen, they had concerns about everything from the height of slides to the space between the railings to the danger of loose S-shaped hooks holding the parts together. One of the primary areas of concern was the asphalt and dirt upon which most of the playgrounds were built, and the potential for head injuries if children fell to the ground from a distance of as little as 3 feet. While the proposed changes to playgrounds remained guidelines and not requirements, almost all schools and public facilities complied, primarily out of pressure from public outcry and a fear of potential litigation for future accidents. As a result, across America, most playgrounds are now fairly sterile. The ground is covered with a cushioned padding. Slides and swings and barriers are made out of large, solid pieces of plastic. And most elements are at heights that are only interesting and challenging to the toddler and preschool set. Very few offer elements of surprise, adventure, or challenge, and you can find the exact same equipment from playground to playground, regardless of where you are in the country. According to Rosen, at the center of the safety obsession is a belief that children are wholly unable to assess and negotiate risk on their own. As a result, one of the primary ways that children can learn the critical skills of assessing and negotiating risk, which is through play, has been taken away from them. At one point in history, it was assumed that children had the intelligence and problem-solving skills to navigate most dangerous situations on their own. Now the overwhelming assumption is that they cannot. Joe Frost, an early crusader in playground safety, has expressed concerns that maybe the worry about safety has gone too far. He states that adults have arrived at the view, quote, that children must somehow be sheltered from all risks of injury. In the real world, life is filled with risks, financial, physical, emotional, and social, and reasonable risks are essential for children's healthy development. And play is the place that children learn to navigate risk from an early age so that they are equipped for dealing with real risk when it comes along, as it surely will later in life. But the reality is that despite all of these changes in playground structure, children are not necessarily safer than they were 40 years ago. The frequency of emergency room visits related to playground equipment was roughly the same in 2012 as it was in 1980. So in 32 years, the incident hadn't really changed. At the same time, the same is true in regards to deaths related to playground accidents. There really hasn't been a change in the number. The more horrific accidents related to playgrounds that made the news and first prompted the wave of lawsuits in the late 70s continue to remain the freakish exceptions that no safety proofing could ever prevent. In fact, one type of injury has increased in the past few years, and that is injury to long bones, so the long bones of the arms and the legs. The thought behind this trend is that children literally no longer know how to fall. Our bodies have instinctual ways of protecting themselves when we fall, but children now rarely have the opportunity to practice that. They're so used to always falling into a ball pit or onto a cushioned surface or from very low heights or having a parent constantly shadow their every move that they literally are not as careful and therefore end up injuring themselves more often. I was at a seminar about a year ago, and the woman presenting was a pediatric occupational therapist. She told a story about her 8-year-old grandson. There had been so many safety concerns at his school that the school playground equipment had been reduced to essentially it was nothing more than a padded floor and some benches for the teachers to sit on during recess. But kids being kids, to occupy themselves, they made a game of jumping over the benches. And during one of these leaps, her grandson caught his foot on the bench and broke his femur. There you go. Ellen Sandester, a professor of early childhood development in Norway, had written her doctoral dissertation on young teens and their need for sensation and risk. She noticed a trend among teens who did not have appropriate outlets for exploring risk and sensory experiences. They instead turned to more high-risk, reckless behaviors as they got older. After having her first child, Sandester noticed how sterile children's playgrounds had become and wondered if the same phenomenon could be happening to children. So she decided to observe and interview children on playgrounds. She concluded that children have a sensory need to taste danger and excitement. The key here, however, is that what they do doesn't actually have to be dangerous. It just has to feel that way to the children. She identified 6 types of risky play that are important for all kids to experience. Exploring heights, handling dangerous tools, such as a hammer or scissors, being near dangerous elements, such as fire or large body of water, rough and tumble play, speed, and exploring on one's own. And so it's important to remember here that children only have to feel that they've encountered danger in one of these things. They don't actually have to be in danger. Sandester identified the last one, exploring on one's own, as the most important for children, especially in regards to having to take responsibility for their own actions and consequences for their own decisions. This leads to the second set of events that Hannah Rosen identified as negatively impacting children's opportunities to play freely. Around the same time that public concern began to peak around playground safety in the late 70s, another news story grabbed the headlines. A 6-year-old boy named Eitan disappeared while walking to the school bus stop by himself in New York City. It was never discovered what happened to Eitan. But all sorts of theories emerged around kidnapping and possible sexual abuse, although there was no evidence ever found around either of those things. This case sparked the movement of putting missing children's faces on milk cartons, for those of you my generation, remember that, and the new normal that children should never, ever talk to strangers. It's very common now to hear parents saying that things aren't like they used to be, and the world is a much more dangerous place than it was when we were kids. However, again, statistics show that random disappearances and kidnappings like Eitan's continue to remain the anomaly. These types of cases have not increased in the past 30 years. In fact, crimes against children have dropped alongside the drop in overall crime rates. What has increased with the rise in divorce and custody wars is the number of children who are abducted by a member of their family, usually the non-custodial parent. According to Rosen, quote, "The gap between what people fear, abduction by a stranger, and what's actually happening, family turmoil and custody battles, is revealing. What has changed since the 1970s is the nature of the American family and the broader sense of community. For a variety of reasons, divorce, more single-parent families, more mothers working, both families and neighborhoods have lost some of their cohesion. It is perhaps natural that trust in general has eroded and that parents have sought to control more closely what they can, most of all, their children. Many of the no-brainer things of yesteryear, playgrounds, the distance between school and home, unsupervised play, streets, children wandering the neighborhood, are seen today by parents as some of the biggest dangers to their children. As a result of this, parents and schools have been driven to create environments for children that minimize the risk of danger and secure children against the supposed threats of the outside world. Unfortunately, these secure environments also significantly limit a child's opportunities to play in ways that allow them to learn the most critical things for their survival as adults. The prolific presence today of special padded playgrounds, enrichment classes, camps, organized sports, and play dates, as well as constant parent supervision, are all evidence for the culture of fear for our children that has materialized in the past few decades. This type of controlled activity fits in neatly with the third cultural change that has affected the way children play, and that is our culture's obsession with achievement. It's not a novel idea to say that Americans are focused on achievement and efficiency. However, it has hit a fever pitch in the past few decades. With more mothers in the workplace, the proliferation of technology, and living farther away from family and friends, it is safe to say that life oftentimes feels like a race. But childhood has become a race as well. Busyness is an epidemic in the American family. I've done an entire lecture on this subject here at Libri that I'm not going to repeat here. But busy children are just as much a part of the game as busy parents. What are we busy doing? We're busy achieving. In an article for The New Yorker, Joshua Rothman blames the problem on modernity itself. He says, quote, "Careers mean more to us because the traditional sources of meaning, like religion, mean less. Increasingly, work is the field upon which we seek to prove our value," end quote. More than ever, parents' value is not only measured by their own performance, but the performance of their children as well. Parents are concerned with their children getting into the best schools, getting the right scholarships, and getting the right opportunities. From a young age, children are herded into formal classes and training, soccer clinics, science camps, piano lessons. Even infants and toddlers are in music and art classes. Part of this trend can be blamed on the desire for parents to have their kids in safe and controlled activities versus roaming the neighborhood unsupervised like wild nomads. That's not safe, and it won't get you into Harvard. But these types of Uber activities are not necessary for most children, and they prevent kids from being able to engage in the type of free, unstructured, and this is the key word here, non-adult mediated play that has shown to be most beneficial for all children. The kiss of death for a speech pathologist is when you assess a child and you ask their parent, how much time during the week does the child spend playing? And the mom says, oh, we have a play date every Thursday morning from 9 to 11. Even play is getting relegated to the realm of enrichment classes. There's nothing wrong with having a play date, of course, but when play is relegated to a two-hour window on Thursday mornings, we're all in trouble. Thanks to social media, part of what comes along with the obsession with children's enrichment is a new kind of competition between parents. All of a sudden, the number and type of activities that your child is enrolled in has become the marker for your success as a parent. How much you love them, how much you care about them, how committed you are to their future success. How badly do you really want them to get into Harvard? In this case, Facebook and Twitter have become every parent's worst enemy. With the touch of a button, you can see all the achievements of every child in your son's kindergarten class. Suddenly, parents who choose to hang out at home and let their kids dig holes in the backyard with sticks look almost neglectful. It's true. Speaking of social media, I love this. Recently on Instagram, I noticed a picture that my friend Kelly posted of her son Soren at soccer practice. Soren is 3 and a half. I'm not sure if this is his first soccer practice or not, but I just about died laughing when I saw the picture with Kelly's caption, "Worth every penny." Soren is showing you, much better than I could, what three-year-olds think of organized sports. Anyone looking at Soren here could easily think, what in the world is he doing? Just laying on the grass doing nothing. His friends are over there kicking balls into the goal like they're supposed to be. I don't actually know Soren very well, but I do know that he loves superheroes. So if I had to make a wager, I would guess that Soren is playing out some kind of superhero adventure in his mind, staring at the sky with his arm in the sky, which really at 3 and a half is exactly what he should be doing. With all of these activities and enrichment classes, kids are also spending more and more time commuting. They're sitting in cars as they and their siblings get carted around from activity to activity. Families are on the go much more than in generations past and travel further distances to visit family and friends. Younger siblings especially average more time in the car for the sake of their older siblings. There's a new generation of kids referred to as bucket babies, which has to do with the advent of the snap-and-go car seat stroller combination. Once upon a time, car seats remained stationary in the car, but now car seats for infants include a seat that snaps out of the car seat base and can be removed and snapped into a stroller or used as a carrier or a seat or other places as well, without ever taking the child out of the seat or out of the bucket. So it's possible now for infants to stay in their carriers for hours at a time, riding in the car to drop off Big Brother at school, then riding on the shopping cart while Mom buys groceries, back home to hang out in the car seat on the table while Mom unloads the groceries and grabs a quick snack, then back in the car for school pickup. The result of all this snap and going is that babies are stationary and strapped into plastic buckets for much longer than they ever have been in the past, hence the term bucket babies. This is Tate again. So if you're not familiar with this seat that he's strapped into, snaps into the car, snaps into the stroller, so he can just stay there. This is, I love this picture. This is my friend Findlay on the far right. Findlay has a twin brother and sister, Davis and Winslow, and they're in the two seats. They are on their way to Atlanta. They're in the airport. They're on their way to Atlanta to visit family. My guess is that Davis and Winslow were put in those seats. They were put in the car to drive to the airport, and they were snapped in their stroller. They hung out in their stroller. They may have stayed in those seats on the plane, even. I don't know, because how are you going to corral Findlay into infants? And then they got snapped back into a stroller and snapped back into a car when they left the airport. So that's a lot of, I don't know for sure. I'm just guessing, but it's a lot of time. I know from my friends, the occupational therapist, how important it is for babies to spend time on the floor, rolling over, grasping for toys, and trying to push up on their hands and arms. Exposure to these types of muscle and mind strengthening activities is increasingly limited as babies and young children spend more and more time being strapped in. Studies have also shown a rise in issues with vision and visual spatial skills in infants because of the constant pressure on the back of their heads, on their occipital lobe, which is the back of your brain, which is the vision center. Your vision's right here. And when kids are always in a seat, more and more kids are having it's no surprise that children are moving less and less than generations past. Because of our cultural drive towards achievement, children's play is getting inched out in favor of more enriching activities. Because of budget cuts and teaching pressure, schools across the country are cutting down on physical education and recess. In most American schools, children now only have about 20 minutes of recess or free play during the school day. We're moving more towards a testing-based system of education, and teachers feel the pressure to take advantage of every minute in the classroom time in order to ready their students for standardized tests. So between school, commuting, and enrichment activities, children are moving less and less. This not only contributes to the epidemic of obesity in America, but it impacts a child's ability to learn. Studies have shown that attention, multitasking skills, executive function, self-regulation, and behavior are all significantly improved by frequent movement and impaired by lack of movement. In one study, researchers looked at brain scans of 7 to 9-year-olds who participated in a daily after-school program encouraging movement and fitness in kids. The kids gathered for a short lesson on fitness, then spent 70 minutes exercising and playing freely. The children who participated in the program were shown to have much better performance on multitasking tests than kids who were not in the program. You can see here the difference, and these are brain scans between brain activity between kids who are in the program and kids who are not. So blue is low activity, red is high activity. So that's a really significant difference. The last cultural shift I'm going to mention is the shift towards technology. I'm actually not going to say very much here for the sake of time, because it's in the news and the media and everywhere we turn. But essentially, the increased presence of technology in the hands of children is not doing anyone, anywhere, any favors. I'm mainly talking about smartphones and tablets, as well as toys that are modeled after these devices and marketed to children. Essentially, most of these toys function for children as cause and effect toys. So I talked about cause and effect toys. That's stage two of object play, which comes out around 9 months. Okay, so this is when we hand this type of technology to a five-year-old, a six-year-old, a seven-year-old. We're essentially handing them something that is developmentally appropriate for a 9 to 12-month-old as far as development of play skills. When older children are spending most of their time playing with devices, they're not engaged in a way that actually facilitates brain development, and it particularly impacts their levels of attention. In an article for Psychology Today, Dr. Jim Taylor says, whether infant recognition of their parents' faces or students paying attention in class, children's immediate environment determines the kind of attention that they develop. In generations past, for example, children directed considerable amounts of their time to reading, an activity that offered few distractions and required intense and sustained attention, imagination, and memory. The advent of television altered that attention by offering children visual stimuli, fragmented attention, and little need for imagination. Then the internet was invented, and children were thrust into a vastly different environment in which, because distraction is the norm, consistent attention is impossible, imagination is unnecessary, and memory is inhibited. End quote. While parents feel much better about their children's safety and well-being these days, it's the kids who are receiving the short end of the stick from all of these changes. Across the board, American children are demonstrating a decrease in attention, problem-solving, physical coordination and strength, creativity, abstract language, self-regulation, and responsibility. We need to think quite seriously about the types of environments we're creating for our children and for ourselves. Especially for those of us who consider ourselves Christians, we need to take a serious look at how these trends are affecting us. How are we shaped by advertising and consumerism? How does a culture of fear impact our own trust of God? What are the ways that we place our value and identity in our own achievements? And what place do we allow technology to have in our own lives? And how do all of those things come into conflict with our faith values? I'm making a bit of a jump here, but I've talked quite a bit about the developmental side of play. Now, as promised, I will move on to the theological. In some ways, I think these are not so easily separated. However, I find it much easier to talk about the developmental side. I hope I've showed how important play is for development for us as human beings. But what of a theological view of play? In my core, I feel that play is a critical component to our lives as believers, both as beings who believe and also as believers who must be in this world. But how do we put this into words? My instinct here is to go back to Jacob's comment, why didn't I just do a lecture on baseball? But I'm too far into it to turn back now. So for help, I started by turning to theologian Jamie Smith in his book, Imagining the Kingdom. In thinking about worship, Smith paints a picture of a physical body united with story and imagination. He notes that our embodiment is a core feature of our humanity, and that we cannot separate anything that we think from our bodies. We experience all of life through our physical selves. He makes a strong argument that as humans, we are actors before we are thinkers, meaning that our actions are generated by much more by what we love than by what we think. We tend to think of it being the other way around, but it was only a few decades ago that neuroscientists thought that babies came into the world with much of their cerebral hardwiring already in place. But we know now that, in fact, that is not the case, that our experiences throughout our lives are massively formative. We currently live in a culture where the cerebral is valued above everything else. But Smith points out that what we think comes primarily from what we first experience through our senses, through our bodies. Anyone who's ever played a sport or danced or been proficient at a musical instrument knows that our bodies have a way of knowing things, holding memory and holding information that's separate from just our cognition. We cannot separate our intellect from our bodies. Smith says that our action emerges from how we imagine the world. Evidence of the strong connection between what we do and who we are. The stories and actions of our lives, both the real and the imagined, shape our character. When we think about stories, there has to be a beginning. Through our imagination, I think that play can lead us in a helpful way back to the beginning. I think it can lead us back to creation. When thinking of play, our minds often automatically go back toward childhood, towards innocence, when the world seemed fresh and new. This is often treated with a wistful sentimentality. To be young again, we say sometimes. While the sentimentality doesn't always serve us well, being led back to the beginning almost always does. In the first few chapters of Genesis, the world is new. God the Creator is giving it shape and form. We have a world before sin when all was good. In Proverbs 8, we read a description of wisdom. But we also have an interesting picture of creation. In 1 Corinthians, Paul tells us that Christ is the wisdom of God. So it's easy in Proverbs 8 to make the connection between wisdom and Christ, and to imagine the Son present as the Father creates the world. I was there when he set the heavens in place, when he marked out the horizon on the face of the deep, when he established the clouds above and fixed securely the fountains of the deep, when he gave the sea its boundary so the waters would not overstep his command, and when he marked out the foundations of the earth. Then I was constantly at his side. I was filled with delight day after day, rejoicing always in his presence, rejoicing in his whole world, and delighting in mankind. The italics here are mine, just to point out the words delight and rejoicing. Some translators say that a more accurate translation of the word that's used, that's translated rejoicing, would be laughing or playing. Either way, we have a picture here of the playfulness and joy of the Father in his creation. As image bearers of the Father, we too are creators. In case you haven't noticed, all children fancy themselves artists. I can't even count the number of times I've heard an adult say, "Oh, I'm not an artist. I'm not an artist. I'm not an artist." But I've never once heard a child say that, ever. In his book, Orthodoxy, G.K. Chesterton writes, "It might be true that the sun rises regularly because he never gets tired of rising. His routine might be due, not to a lifelessness, but to a rush of life. The thing I mean can be seen, for instance, in children, when they find some game or joke that they especially enjoy. A child kicks his legs rhythmically through excess, not absence of life. Because children have abounding vitality, because they are in spirit fierce and free. Therefore, they want things repeated and unchanged. They always say, 'Do it again.' And the grown-up person does it again until he is nearly dead. For grown-up people are not strong enough to exult in monotony. But perhaps God is strong enough to exult in monotony. It is possible that God says every morning, 'Do it again,' to the sun, and every evening, 'Do it again,' to the moon. It may not be automatic necessity that makes all daisies alike. It may be that God makes every daisy separately, but has never gotten tired of making them. It may be that he has the eternal appetite for infancy, for we have sinned and grown old, and our Father is younger than we." When we go back to the beginning, before the fall, before the brokenness of the world crept into our minds and hearts, we see who we were originally made to be. Play can take us back to the beginning, to the place where we love because God first loved us and loved us enough to make us in his own image. Play allows us to continue the work that God started in the garden. It didn't end with the fall. Play gives us an avenue to continue to create, to breathe, to speak, and to relate. While play can lead us back to creation, it simultaneously, I think, is a door that leads us forward towards eternity. Imagination is a requirement to even begin to think about eternity. But when integrated into regular life, play can help us get there, or at least get a little bit closer. We live in a temporal world, and it can be extremely difficult to get our minds around dwelling with God forever. One of our students, Jeff, pointed me to the work of sociologist Peter Berger, which I found very helpful here in regards to time. Berger says, in playing, one steps out of one time into another. For those of you who have played, who've really played, you know that this is true. Somehow, when we play, there's a shift in how we experience time. It's almost as if we step outside of time and the weight of everyday life. It can even leave us flustered sometimes. We can say, oh no, I lost track of time. That's a really interesting statement, isn't it? Have you thought about that? What does it mean to lose track of time? Berger says that play creates an enclave in the everyday, a territory that is separate from the normal rigors of time. He says, when one is playing, one is on a different time, no longer measured by the standard units of the larger society, but rather by the peculiar ones of the game in question. In the serious world, it may be 11 a.m. on such and such a day, month, and year. But in the universe in which one is playing, it may be the third round, the fourth act, the allegro movement, or the second kiss. In playing, one steps out of one time and into another. Much of the sentimentality that exists around childhood has to do with that period of life where death is not a reality. Our own deaths, the deaths of those around us, and the death of the world we live in. Many argue that play is a way to escape the harsh realities of adult life and deny what will inevitably come. But play, in fact, is not a denial, but a preparation for all of us who are Christians of the true nature of what death means, which is eternity with God. Berger says that joy is play's intention. C.S. Lewis says that joy is the serious business of heaven. That is ultimately what God calls us to, the joy of our union with Christ, the place where death is no more, not because we don't die, but because death is not the final word. We are always being called to the more. Play is not just the work of children. It's the work of all of us who long to see the kingdom of heaven realized in this world. It helps us to access the creativity and imagination necessary to glance the eternity that Christ offers us. In his book, Christ Plays in 10,000 Places, Eugene Peterson takes his title from a poem by the priest and poet Jared Manley Hopkins, a statement on the end of human life well lived. As kingfishers catch fire, dragonflies draw flame. As tumbled over rim in roundy wells, stones ring. Like each tucked string tells, each hung bells, bow swung, finds tongue to fling out broad its name. Each mortal thing does one thing and the same, deals out that being indoors each one dwells. Selves, goes itself, myself, it speaks and spells, crying, what I do is me. For that I came. I saw more. The just man justices, keeps grace, that keeps all his goings graces, acts in God's eye what in God's eye he is, Christ. For Christ plays in 10,000 places, lovely in limbs and lovely in eyes not his, to the Father through the features of men's faces. Hopkins' poetry. It's actually a wonderful example of an artist really playing with his medium, with sound and words. You can hear it in the rhythm of his poems. This is a beautiful picture of Christ playing in each one of us, giving evidence to the love and life of the Father through his creation. In our playing, we evidence the reality of Christ to one another, but we also take what God made us to be and we offer it back in worship to him. Peterson says of his book, a poem is a complex matter of sounds and rhythms, meanings nuanced and plain, the ordinary and the unexpected juxtaposed, all put together in such a way as to involve us as participants in life, more life, real life. This is my intent, to enlist your play in the play of Christ. I don't have anything new to say, Christians already know all the basics simply by being alive and baptized. We are already in on it, for Christ does, in fact, play in 10,000 places. But I do hope to get you in on a little more of it, we who are the limbs and eyes and faces in and through whom Christ plays. I love that. We are already in on it. Christ is at play within each one of us. Joy is what God intended for us. It is the work of the Spirit within each one of us and a mark of our true freedom that we find in our life with Him. C.S. Lewis sums this up brilliantly, of course, in his book, Letters to Malcolm. He says, "We, or at least I, shall not be able to adore God on the highest of occasions if we have learned no habit of doing so in the lowest. At best, our faith and reason will tell us that He is adorable, but we shall not have found Him so, not have tasted and seen. Any patch of sunlight in a wood will show you something about the sun which you could never get from reading books on astronomy. These pure and spontaneous pleasures are patches of Godlight in the woods of our experience." This description ties in beautifully with the descriptions of play that the Labrie students came up with. Pleasure, wonder, creativity, fun. Scripture tells us to taste and see that the Lord is good. All of the reasons that our current culture makes it hard for children to play well, it makes it hard for grown-ups too. It's tempting to take a book's description of the sun and just keep going, rather than experience something of the actual sun itself. But play gives us opportunities to witness and experience God-light, to taste and see something of God Himself. And this is the heart of worship, not to read something about God, but to dwell with Him. In our minds, yes, but also through our imaginations and our bodies and our creativity and our prayer. To not just be thankful for God, but as Lewis says, for our minds to run back up the sunbeam to the sun itself. In closing, I'm so tempted here to misquote Shakespeare. Play is the thing. That's what I want to say. It's not what Shakespeare said. I hope I've shown you that the ability to play is good, is crucial, is a worthwhile human gift that we have been given. Not to be relegated to the world of children's nurseries, play is in many ways the real work that we've been called to. For through it, we learn to learn. We speak, we hear, we know, we navigate this beautiful world that we've been placed in. Through play, we gain a knowing far more deep and real than what we can access through books and intellectual thought. I'm going to read a quote, close here with a quote from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. It's the end of the book, and Lewis paints a really beautiful picture of play here, of children playing and of Christ playing in 10,000 places. The scene here is just after Aslan has been sacrificed on the stone table, and Lucy and Susan have stayed hidden to care for his dead body and to weep over his death. But to their amazement, he breaks through his shackles and is restored to life. "Oh, children," said the lion, "I feel my strength coming back to me. Oh, children, catch me if you can." He stood for a second, his eyes very bright, his limbs quivering, lashing himself with his tail. Then he made a leap high over their heads and landed on the other side of the table. Laughing, though she didn't know why, Lucy scrambled over it to reach him. Aslan leapt again. A mad chase began. Round and round the hilltop, he led them, now hopelessly out of their reach, now letting them almost catch his tail, now diving between them, now tossing them in the air with his huge and beautifully velveted paws and catching them again, and now stopping unexpectedly so that all three of them rolled over together in a happy laughing heap of fur and arms and legs. It was such a romp as no one has ever had except in Narnia, and whether it was more like playing with a thunderstorm or playing with a kitten, Lucy could never make up her mind. And the funny thing was that when all three finally lay together, panting in the sun, the girls no longer felt in the least tired or hungry or thirsty. I have a very practical streak, And I'm always tempted to make these lectures as practical as possible, but for the sake of time, I'm going to restrain myself from doing that. But I do want to challenge you to take a look at the ways that you are or are not allowing yourself to play, and that you are or not allowing the children in your life to play as well. I think we should all try to prove Abby Kies wrong when she said that grown-ups don't know how to play. I'm going to stop here, but I want to leave you with a bit of wisdom that I found where all great wisdom comes from, which is the wall of a bathroom in a restaurant in New York City. We don't stop playing because we grow old. We grow old because we stop playing. So I stop in here. Open it up. Sarah.
Thank you, Mary Frances. I'm curious about the developmental phases, what's going on in the brain, the kind of play that corresponds to that.
Yeah.
Do you know what the next several phases are and what the adult phase looks like? Because where I struggle is with playing with a four-year-old who's in a certain realm of developmental play.
Yeah.
And that doesn't quite register as play for me. It can actually register as work.
Yeah.
Yep. And incredibly exhausting. And so while I feel chastened by adults don't know how to play, I also feel like, well, you don't know how I play.
Absolutely.
And so... Yeah, I guess I'm curious.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that's when I'm going to respond, but I think I'd love to kick it open to other people. I'd love to hear other people's ideas as grown-ups of how you play. This is something that I've been thinking about for myself the past year, and I found it challenging as well. Just to start clinically, the six stages of object play, there's no seventh stage after that. There are some other stages of play that have to do with not only how children are playing with objects, that's what I was talking about with object play, but also relational play. So how children develop skills playing with other people and how they integrate themselves with other people. but really what you're seeing after the age of 5 or 6 is just a real boon in language skills. So it's less of a change in play style, but a real development in language skills and capacity for language, and then putting that on top of the play. There's no documented stage that takes us up into our 30s and 40s and beyond. But I think you bring up a great point, because I actually had the same thought when Abby said yesterday, I told her, you know, I'm going to be talking to grown-ups about play. Like, what do you think grown-ups need to know about play? I said, do you think grown-ups even need to know how to play? She's like, no. I mean, it was just, you know, no, they don't know how to play. Which is fair, I mean, from her perspective, but that's not necessarily true. So I think play is personal. I mean, I just want to go back to kind of what the Labrie definition of play from the Labrie students, the list I generated with the Labrie students, which I loved, I would say, what brings you joy? What incites your imagination? What is fun for you? What's funny to you? Who do you trust? You know, what incites a sense of wonder? What can you do that you feel like, we talked about lack of competition, but I think here too is lack of judgment. I personally love, I love working with my hands. I love doing artistic and creative things, and I have a very loud voice of judgment in my head. And so I very rarely do it unless I have a picture and I know what the end result's going to look like and I want it to be this thing. I have a hard time entering in just to the process for the sake of process. I judge myself. I feel like I'm competing with myself. So I would say... with adults, this is pretty good measuring stick here. One thing that you said about it being exhausting to play with a four-year-old, there's two things with that. One is children just have a physical vitality that adults don't have. So there's a piece of it of the physicality of children that is exhausting for the most fit adult. I read a study a couple years ago that I thought was fascinating, where they took a two-year-old and an aerobics instructor. And for something like 10 minutes, it was a very short period of time, the aerobics instructor was meant to mimic every physical movement that the two-year-old made. And they had put things in the room that, you know, when a two-year-old steps up a step like that, that's no big deal to us. But they put things in, so the equivalent of a two-year-old doing this to climb a stair, the aerobics instructor was climbing on things. It shouldn't last 10 minutes. She got too tired. And so, I mean, that's a real, I mean, the children's physique, I mean, they're just closer to the ground. And, you know, there is something physical about that that's just much harder for adults. So I think we need to give ourselves a break on that one. And I think that there is something, when I talked about kind of going back to the beginning and going back, there is something, we talk about the innocence of childhood, but there's something real in that. You know, there's a weight and a heaviness that we carry as adults because of the roads we've walked on and the things that we've lived. And just as I talk about how much we learn and experience and know through our bodies, we've learned and we hold hard knowledge, hard things in our bodies as well. And we carry that with us all the time in a way that most children don't. And we live in a reality. Not that children don't live in reality, they do, but their reality is a different, it's like reality light compared with us. And those are, I think, significant factors in helping us to let go and engage and play. And so I think just being honest with yourself about, and I think not beating yourself up when you can't do dinosaur stuff for like hour number four or whatever, you know.
I know we listed lack of competition in that section in our notes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely obvious that competition is not fun at a certain point. I was wondering at which developmental stage does competition begin to be fun? Because a lot of children's mm-hmm. games, while not being overly competitive, still like even like throwing a ball into a hoop or something like that does have a specific goal, and or trying to beat a clock. Is there a specific stage of it that when the competition becomes fun? Because for me, ping pong is not fun unless we start actually trying to play.
Trying to win. Right. Yeah. There's not a specific age. I would say once kids are 2.5 to 3, they can get the concept of something like race, like let's race. Let's see who gets there first. They can get those types of concepts. As far as specific, the concept of winning as far as a game, a board game, or something like that, a little bit older. And that really depends a lot on the child. Some kids love that and really thrive off of that. Some kids don't. They hate it. And, you know, we're also, I didn't talk about this, but, I mean, we're in a culture now where it's like, there's no winners and losers. We're all, you know, with kids, everybody gets a trophy. Everybody shows up, gets a trophy. You know, so that's shifting. But what's interesting about that, actually, is that, kids are not stupid. I mean, you have a soccer team. Yeah, like there's the soccer team, like you've got all the 7-year-olds lined up. You line up the 7-year-olds and it's like everybody gets a trophy, great. But the kids know. The kids know who the good players are. The kids know who the bad players are. And they know if they fit into that category or not. It's really for the adults, I think, honestly. It's for the grown-ups more. Because kids know those things. And then there's sometimes a confusion of like, why? Like they know they haven't earned it. They know they don't deserve it.
I just think in response to what Sarah was saying, I think a big part of it, for speaking personally, playing with my kids is infinitely more exhausting the more concerned I am about their protection and their safety. I mean, one of the reasons why it's so exhausting, because you're running around trying to keep them from whacking their head on a rock. And so that's one of my struggles, because I totally believe what you're saying, is that there's some developmental things that can only happen with non-parental mediated activities. But at the same time, I really don't want my kid to... I mean, the average bump and scrape and kind of thing, but you know, I don't want them to fall off the trampoline and break their neck. So yeah. there is a fear element which makes any participation in their play much more taxing than mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Even if you're not literally leaping to catch them, you're,
sure.
you're mentally
yeah.
ready
yeah.
for anything and ready to say, no, don't do that. No, you know.
And I think you're also checking yourself because you know that if you do something, they might copy you and you have a much better sense of body awareness than they do. I mean, like, you could do something and be fine and they do it and it's bad news. And yeah. so, yeah.
Because one more comment mm-hmm. about that, about the, I think for me as an adult play, what Peter Berger said is really significant. Mm-hmm. It's something that we're entering into a different time. Usually it's some sort of activity that has nothing to do with anything else in my yeah. life at all. So nothing that would call me back to regular time.
Right, yeah.
And that's what play often is for me, which is not, does not always coincide with playing with my kids. Because I agree
yeah.
with Sarah, like when I'm playing with my kids, it's not play for me. Yeah. always. Sometimes it really is. Because
mm-hmm.
sometimes you're rolling around in the grass and wrestling actually are concepts of play really coincide. And
right.
It's great. And other times it's just not.
Right, right.
Playing make-believe with my daughters, for instance, is not a play for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's work. It's work. Yeah. 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 Absolutely. Right.
I just wonder with the list of the three students play, and I just wonder how if you would relate any of your concept of play and these concepts to the set, to the Sabbath, and to a different kind of day. You know, I mean, the pattern for adults is.
Mm-hmm.
is we work 6 days and there's a day of rest, and the picture in the scripture is very much a sort of meant to be a kind of a foretaste of
mm-hmm.
of the new heavens and earth.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think all those categories would be there. And I just mm-hmm. wonder whether if this could be a kind of encouragement for us all to take Sabbath more seriously as mm-hmm. a time not just to do religious duties, but to try to cultivate
yeah.
play in our lives.
That's a great point, Marty. I hadn't thought about that. You reminded me, I used to volunteer for a ministry organization. I worked with middle school and high school students, and one summer I was a leader at a 2-week-long program for kind of juniors and seniors in high school, and these were prep school kids, boarding school, private school kids, so they were all like super achievers and super athletes and all these things, really competitive. And we really tried in this 2-week period to have Sabbath. We talked about Sabbath and Sunday being Sabbath. And they would be like, well, like, can we go play soccer? Can we, you know, and you see this like competitive, like, it's like, well, for them, like, they're not going to just go kick the soccer ball around. It's going to become this like fierce game. And so we talked about, somebody coined the term, I think, leisurely play. I think that's what we called it. And so we said, yes, you can play soccer if it's leisurely play. But trying to help, you know, because it's sort of this like all or nothing, all or nothing. But I think, you're right. I mean, I think these are all things that we will experience in some way in heaven. And I love that idea of connecting Sabbath to it. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that. But, yeah, it's a good point.
Not that we shouldn't be trying to get little interludes of play throughout the week.
Sure, yeah, no.
To
it's a helpful way to frame it.
And obviously, people have, you know, if your work means you're working on Sunday, your Sabbath day isn't going to be...
Right.
But we all need that pattern of one day.
Mm-hmm.
Six and one is a really important pattern
yeah.
in Scripture.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Rest of recreation, whatever yeah. that's going to be.
It's true. It's true. Other things, yeah.
I'm a twins parent, so I really appreciated the stroller. I own that stroller. the devil snap and goes the whole
life. Yeah. It's very convenient. I should say it's a revolutionized people's lives. So.
Praise be to God.
Yeah.
So I find myself as somebody who entered parenthood in their late 30s. I hit a problem, right? Like, I now have two small newborns that I had no idea how to transport. Oh, look, there's a product someone's going to sell to me. he solves my problem.
Yeah.
Right? And so I'm finding that every turn I hit a new product that is a culture, right? That
yeah.
some advertiser and some
totally.
You know, industry has created to solve a set of problems. And of course, that comes with an intrinsic set of values. Mm. But I don't have an alternate set of values to stand against those, right? Like I don't have a culture. Mm. I haven't hung out with kids. You have the benefit of hanging out with kids. I've never done that as a college professor. I don't want them until they're done with high school, right?
Yeah.
So let's not have them until then. They're not yeah. 2 1-year-olds. And so I don't know how to stand against that sort of the culture that is in that way, because they don't have an alternative model. It's like I'd like to cook in a different way, but I've never been around a different kind of food. And so yeah. I mean, I know that there are other cookbooks, but
yeah.
I can't live it. I don't have that
yeah.
model for me. And then my second question is, as I look at my different options, I live in the city, which is, I think, unsafe in some, like, practical ways that maybe living out here.
The street's a lot closer to the front door. Yeah.
And it's really fast, right?
Yeah.
It's paved in, and there's speed bumps, and they go fast, right?
Yeah.
So, and then I look at my peers and think that they're the culture I have to interact with, right?
Mm.
And so there's this discussion of, and there's too many play dates and there's too much structured play. But if I opt out of that, nobody else opts out of that.
Mm.
Right? And so then it's just the four of us sitting in our living room.
Right, yeah.
Right now,
yeah.
So how do I react with a culture
yeah.
to play, to live out of? And then how do I live in a culture that doesn't have the values that I want?
Yeah.
Because I can't change.
Sure.
Change that culture.
So. Yeah, yeah.
Please guide me.
Yeah, those are good questions. I'll do my best. I feel like I should say what I feel like I have to give this caveat. I didn't give it today. I don't actually have children, so I feel like when I stand up here and I talk about children, I need to put that out there. But, you know, I think your first question about kind of the stuff, I think, and this is the thing we all have, I mean, we all have to be honest with ourselves about how much we're believing what consumer America is telling us about the stuff, whether it's a snap and go stroller or whether it's an iPhone or whatever it is. Like, this is the thing that's going to revolutionize your life. Everything out there is going to help us. It's going to make our life easier in some way. And that's not a bad thing. But I think, you know, in this case, the snap and go stroller is a great thing. It makes parents' lives easier. I think for things like that, I would say just being aware of, and maybe this means talking with other parents or talking to your pediatrician or reading some parenting books, but I think it, which I'm sure you've already done, but I think there's a sense of like, there's nothing wrong with the snap and go stroller, but if you realize that your one-year-olds are spending an hour, 2 hours at a time strapped into a bucket, you know, maybe thinking about like, okay, how can we redo the way we're doing things so that they are on the floor doing tummy time and they are playing with each other. They're playing with toys or playing with us as adults. I think it's the balance. So, I mean, the problem of falling off one side of the fence is that then you can fall off the other side of the fence, right? And so I think the key, is just balance and looking at kind of how your children spend their day, who they're spending with. It sounds like they're quite young, so they're not in school. They're not school age yet. One of the things, there's Leslie. I have a friend here who, Leslie, she's an early intervention occupational therapist. An early intervention is birth to 3. And everybody I know who works in early intervention tells parents, your child's most significant toy or thing is you as the parent. That's the most significant thing for your kid. And so I think just making sure that your children are interacting together and with you and with your wife and Sarah's on the other extreme of that. Yeah. 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 With little kids, we're talking babies, Sarah, babies, little kids. And I think just striking a balance there, and being honest with yourself about your own consumer habits and why you're buying something and that, which can be ugly to look at sometimes, hard to look at. I think the cultural piece is there's nothing wrong with the play date, but the thing there is if we think, oh yeah, my kid had a play date on Thursday morning, it's okay that they're in the seat all day, in the bucket all day because they had their play date kind of thing. It's more just the mentality around how we're packaging those things. And I think that... I mean, this is something I'm going to just use an example, Nikki. A couple years ago, Nikayla and Ben had a birthday party for the girls. I can't remember how they were, but just up at their house, and they invited a couple friends over when they turned 4. And one of the moms, I think you guys did a tea party or something, and the girls could bring their dresses or something. And one of the moms said, "Is Nikayla?" was floored. And these are mostly Southboro families and people who live in houses not quite this big, but large here, and have means, most of them. And one of the moms said, "Nikayla, like, was floored, like, loved the party, and said, we've never been to a birthday party in somebody's home before. They've never been to a birthday party in somebody's home." And so I think
they're at McDonald's or at,
yeah, they're at McDonald's or at the Play Space or the Jumpy Place or Chuck E. Cheese or whatever. And so I think there are ways. What's that?
Or the American Girl doll store.
The American Girl doll store, yeah. And so I think there's a piece where, I mean, at Liberty, where I feel like I have to wave this banner, where we talk about hospitality a lot. But I think it's the thing where it's like, you know, we're going to be home Sunday afternoon. Come over. It's not a play date. It's not a, just come over, have a meal. And to have with your neighbors, with the people, to be together in a way that's not a sort of scheduled thing on your Google Calendar. It's hard to do. I mean, I'm going to let you respond to that.
Well, just, you have your own experience of what it would like to be a child.
Mm-hmm.
And Ben and I have twins, and, you know, they were at first children. We didn't have a manual, but we knew when things were not right with other, like, when we're asked how much screen time our one-year-old had, you know, at a pediatrician's appointment. Like, they don't have screen time at a year-old. So there are intuitive things, you know, as yourself, being a child in your own culture as growing up as a child and wanting to give that to your own child. Rely on that more than you think.
Yeah. Sue?
Bringing children up, I think I was actually really surprised at how I let external pressure in, or how other people's opinions affected me in terms of what your children should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And we came when our eldest was about 18 months old, and we came from a very sort of, not alternative, but sort of a much more laid-back, granola-esque, very tight community in England to here. And again, you know, this is not normal America here because we're in Liberty and everyone's sort of slightly different anyway. Catholic Christian school where family is really emphasized. But still, if I ever went to anything in the town or with neighbors, even I was an older mother, felt huge pressure. Oh my goodness, he's not in any sport. And they don't do any after school things. And what should they be doing? And I had to actually talk myself down from those allergies to hold on, you know, what really is important here. And it does help to have people to talk to. It helps to read some books, not all books. but, you know, try and find people who are of like mind. And yeah, and that's the play dates. You know, so many play dates are just for parents to get together and compare.
Mm.
And, yeah, so there are people you can seek out.
Hang on, Ben. Okay. Yeah.
I grew up in a pre-Christian environment with an anthropologically oriented mother.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have in my brain that is not the Hopi way, in the sense that our family was different from other families, and it was just, we got protected in feeling like it was okay to be different by her anthropological sense that we had a family. And that was the way it was, and this was okay.
Mm.
So, I mean,
what else? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ben, were you gonna? Did you want to?
Well, I was gonna say, I'm sure this is a well-known term, but I only heard it a little while ago, which is a yes environment, finding places which are yes environments for your kids. Mm-hmm. I actually found that sort of helpful, and it was a concept that actually I sort of intuitively felt but not articulated. Some place where you can go and let your kid just experience the freedom of running around without a lot of danger. Like, for instance, the beach. Obviously, you don't want your kid to run into the ocean and drown, mm-hmm. but there's a vast amount of space in which they
can. You've got a lot of lead time before that happens, right?
And yeah, mm-hmm. or just even walking nearby here where they can, out into some of the fields, which are mm-hmm. open to the public, where you can watch them for hundreds of yards and nothing is going to happen to them. Mm-hmm. And they can just run and you don't have to say no about anything. Mm-hmm. Except maybe how they treat their sibling or whatever. But finding places where you were as a parent, I found it just restful.
Yeah.
To go to some place where I don't have to tell this kid no every 2 seconds. Mm-hmm. I just let them run, and I know that it's good for them. Mm-hmm. Because I think part of the culture of fear today, and maybe this is more in urban settings, I don't know, is that there's almost every environment is a place in which you always have to say no mm-hmm. to your child to protect them, or at least you feel you do.
Yeah.
So I found that to try to think of and find and maybe create yes environments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I noticed that a lot of people you quoted are kind of naysayers to this. Mm. In other words, they're saying, wait a minute, look what's kept going on. Mm-hmm. It used to be this way. We've lost a lot. Now, what about a revolution? Mm. I mean, who is anybody pushing back?
Yes.
Is anybody listening to these folks?
Yeah. There's been a huge...
I'd love to hear...
I have
four people in this living.
Yeah,
in this company.
I have something else to say, but you let Lenny. No, you go. I'm going to look for something.
Well, I've done a lot of work on this same topic. There's been a real counter. There's been a real. A lot of the books came out right after 9/11 that were all about, all this fear and all this
safety.
Stuff. And safety and stuff, but there's been this response now. The books, even a dangerous book for boys, and 50 things. What was that?
There's a dangerous book for girls too.
Yeah, and there's been a kind of counter thing of even playgrounds now.
Dangerous
playgrounds, and reintroducing danger. And because there's a bunch of psychologists are writing things about this, Mary Frances was saying, that if you don't let them take any risks at all, that when they get free, they're going to take really, really crazy risks.
Yeah.
You know, really bad risks. And so controlled, in a controlled environment, mm-hmm. being able to play with fire.
So, one example that I didn't mention, but the Hannah Rosen article for The Atlantic, she talks about this playground. It's actually in Wales, and it's called The Land. This is actually her son playing in it, but I have a couple photographs. But it came about, it's this, I'm going to show you a couple pictures. It's this place where
it's a shanty town.
It's a shanty town.
Called the slums.
Everything there, yeah. There's no formal playground equipment. I mean, it's like old mattresses, carts, old tires, things like this. So it's an enclosed area. So it is it's enclosed. There is a door. But it's this open space, and kids can come play there. They have people who work there, so there would be one or two adults at a time. They're not necessarily parents, but one or two adults who work there. But they literally do not intervene at all unless someone is seriously, seriously injured or someone is that close. And they don't. They don't intervene. I mean, they are there in case there's some serious physical something that happens to the kids, but the kids, it's old tires, old equipment. There's a fire pit. There is water there. And the kids just run and play. And what's interesting is that they have to build this and to get sort of the area, the parents and people who live in this area on board, they had to do all these studies and present all this stuff. And so they have this kind of handbook on each sort of element, like fire and water and the tires and a list of potential benefits. I'm going to see if I can find this in here. Of potential benefits and then potential risks for each one. And it's great because... Okay, here we go. It says, although the play workers almost never stopped the kids from what they're doing, before the playground had even opened, they'd filled binders with risk benefits assessments for nearly every activity. In the 2 years since it's opened, no one has been injured outside the occasional scraped knee. Here's the list of benefits for fire. It can be a social experience to sit around with friends, make friends, to sing songs to dance around, to stare at. It can be a cooperative experience where everyone has jobs. It can be something to experiment, to take risks, to test its properties, its heat, its power, to relive our revolutionary past. The risks that are listed are burns from fire or fire pit, and children accidentally burning each other with flaming cardboard or wood. So you have this list of benefits, and then this is the list of potential risks. And it says, in this case, the benefits win because a play worker is always nearby, watching for impending accidents, but otherwise letting the children figure out lessons about fire on their own. And then she tells the story about, kids throwing stuff in. And so places like this are popping up. I don't know in America. All the ones I've heard of, Canada, Wales, are other countries. So I don't know that we're there yet in America.
I think there might be one. Grown-ups are doing
CrossFit,
so
it's true. Anything could happen. But there's also a rise in schools. I don't even know the names, but sort of forest schools, and again, they're more popular in parts of Europe than they are here. But where children spend most of the day outside, actually, instead of inside, and a lot of the learning is done. Waldorf schools are based around that model as well. There's not a lot out there. Yeah, but slowly. Yeah. Colin?
In your studying this, read any statistics or psychology about how much you should and shouldn't caution kids on being careful, like always saying, be careful or watch out?
I have not. Lenny might have some thoughts on that. I haven't studied that specifically, but I think, that is very much kind of embedded in the culture of fear there. And also what I talked about before, this assumption that kids are unable to independently assess risk. And I've shared this example before, but I have a friend who is a single mom, and her son, who's her oldest child, it was quite a cautious child by nature, and she really wanted him to be taking more risks, and she was concerned about her own kind of saying, like, oh, be careful. And so she made a very intentional move to change her own vocabulary. And so instead of saying, be careful, she tells him to pay attention. And that, like, there's a difference there, you know, there's a difference. And that's been helpful for her. But I don't know, Lenny, do you want to?
I just had a discussion with a bunch of moms this week that I gave a similar kind of talk to. Very interesting discussion, a wonderful discussion. It reminded me of the fact that there were so many of them who felt like they were the only one. And when they were together, they realized, that this one mom was talking about the neighbors calling and said, do you know your boys are out playing in the backyard?
Yeah.
But one of these moms and I think it's age appropriate where you can do this, but instead of just reacting like be careful, they had found something and were making some kind of weapon or something with something sharp, and instead of oh no be careful, it was now what do you think might happen but she engaged in this discussion of just questions. And without oh no, kind of response at all. Very, very casual. It was just, it was brilliant.
What could
and
go
the,
wrong?
And the kids, yeah, kind of had a discussion. And then the 8-year-old said to the 6-year-old, I don't think we better do this. This is going to be too dangerous for you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it just came out of a discussion of questions about.
There's something, this isn't responding directly to your question, Colin, but there's something I did read, one of the articles that I read, and this is just thinking about the question about even the culture that you live in. But, you know, I was quite struck by the Hannah Rosen quote about this spirit of fear that exists among parents, but it much more has to do with perceived dangers, perceived fears that really have to do more with a breakdown in families and a breakdown in communities than actual threats. And in one article I read, there was a neighborhood where the parents kind of got together and said, like, we want our kids to have a little more autonomy. We want them to be able to do more unsupervised. And so the parents kind of made an agreement together, one, to really watch out for each other's children, which is kind of a no-no these days, you know? I mean, there's a sense of, like, as an adult, it's, you know, it's a liability if you intervene, if you tell a child, oh, you can't do that, you know, don't discipline my child, don't. I mean, I was disciplined all over the place by neighbors, and, you know, and that's just really not done anymore. But in this neighborhood, the parents really got together to kind of say, we want there to be more freedom for our kids. And there were sort of these rules that they developed. That's kind of like, okay, once you're 6, you can go as far as the whatever pole by yourself. You know, when you're 7, you can go as far as the store at the end of the street, but you have to have somebody with you. And the kids kind of knew the rules and the parents knew the rules and they created an environment where, you know, I mean, that's hard. I mean, like transforming Beacon Hill or whatever. I mean, that's a different thing. Right. But I do think there is something in that community piece. I mean, one of the like famous stories in my family was we were very good friends with the people that lived catty corner across the street from us when I was growing up. And one of my mom's favorite stories is, it was my sister's birthday party. She was, I think, 5, maybe. And the party was starting, and people were arriving. And she couldn't, like, my parents couldn't find my sister anywhere. Like, she wasn't around. And so my mom picked up the phone and called Janet, who lived across the street, whose children were at our house for the party. And my mom was like, I can't find Catherine. Is she at your house? And Janet was like, I don't know. Let me go check. And she went back, and Catherine had let herself into the house, which we used to do all the time, and was back in Matt's room playing with his toys. Like, she needed some space. And, you know, and so Jana was like, I'll get her. I'll bring her home. I mean, you know, for her own birthday party. I mean, that would never happen. You know, I mean, that would never happen now. But my mom, my parents were here a couple weeks ago, and I was talking about this with them, and my mom said, yeah, but we knew that Janet was looking out for you. We knew that. That, you know, there was a sense with our neighbors that it didn't just have to be my parents' eyes on us. We lived next door to a swimming pool. It's like, public, you know, scary, you know, nothing ever happened. But I do think that, I don't want to pretend like it's an easy thing to do, but I think communities can make shifts too. If there are, like Lenny said, if there are parents who, and I think a lot of times parents do feel like, I'm the only one, like, I'm letting my kids play with sticks in the backyard. I'm a horrible parent, you know, but there are other parents out there too, so I think it's sort of changing the culture where you are. Yeah. Okay, then I'm going to stop. Thank you for listening.